Good morning. Our reading was written by Martin Luther King Jr. in 1967. Being a Negro in America is not a comfortable existence. It means being part of the company of the bruised, the battered, the scarred, and the defeated. Being a Negro in America means trying to smile when you want to cry. It means trying to hold on to physical life and psychological death. It means the pain of watching your children grow up with clouds of inferiority in their mental skies. It means having your legs cut off and then being condemned for being a cripple. It means seeing your mother and father spiritually murdered by the slings and arrows of daily exploitation, and then being hated for being an orphan. Being a Negro in America means being harried by day and haunted by night by a nagging sense of nobodiness and constantly fighting to be saved from the poison of bitterness. It means the ache and anguish of living in so many situations where hopes unborn have died. Martin Luther King Jr. Well, on Monday, April 18th, 40 people, including about 10 from right here at C3, boarded a bus that would turn into a truly transformational experience. If you were a part of that trip, would you stand up? There's a whole bunch of people here. Some are here regularly, some are visiting. Take a look and know the people you want to talk to and ask about their experience. This wasn't a vacation. It wasn't a mission trip. It was really about being immersed in another way of living and being. The Civil Rights Road Trip offered an opportunity for us to be genuinely uncomfortable as we journeyed into the South to be confronted with painful truths about our nation's past and admit painful truths about our nation today. And Cindy, what a beautiful reflection you offered detailing that whole experience. We drove, as Cindy explained, through Nashville and arrived at Birmingham, where we spent the night at the historic Tutwiler Hotel. In the morning, we visited the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute just across the street from the 16th Street Baptist Church. We moved on to Selma, where we walked the Pettus Bridge, which was the starting point of the 50-mile march to Montgomery. And while we easily drove those 50 miles, we were ever mindful of the path that we were following. We spent the night in Montgomery, and in the morning we drove past the Capitol to signify the end of that long walk before proceeding to the Legacy Museum and the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, where we spent the day before driving on to Memphis. Here we started the day stopping at the Mason Temple Church, the last place that Martin Luther King spoke before being assassinated, and then touring the National Civil Rights Museum and the Lorraine Motel. And about 1 o'clock in the morning, we were back in Grand Haven. Having packed an enormous amount of information and experience into just 4 days. During each of those days, we took time to reflect together on what we were experiencing and how it was impacting us. We are here today to bear witness to this pilgrimage and to share with you how we have been changed. So I'm joined today by this incredible panel of C3ers who were part of the Civil Rights Road Trip, Betty Porter, Ellie Williams, Chris Moulter Gray, and Tom Reddick. I want to arrange our sharing today in terms of the four pillars of body, mind, shadow, and spirit. So we start with body. I can tell you that I have wanted to visit the Legacy Museum since it opened as the Lynching Museum. And the reason that I was so excited about this trip was that I believed it would be so much richer an experience to have in community as opposed to by myself. So my first question to the rest of you is simply, why did you take your body on this trip? Sure.
My father and I took a trip just before lockdown and went down and saw my niece and his granddaughter who'd fallen in love. We got to meet the Mahmood a Syrian refugee she married. She speaks five languages, that helped. And then we went and toured all the Montgomery sites and we said, this is so cool, we need to come back and do the Selma loop and everything else. And we promised ourselves in 6 months, we're gonna come back and we're gonna, you know, because Christy's gonna get married, we gotta go do that. So COVID intervened and then Milty died exactly 2 years after this promise to come back. And when I heard this trip was happening, I was like, oh my God, synchronicity, Dr. Young? I think so. Because, you know, this was on the bucket list of Milt and Tom, and now it's on my bucket list. And it was really, for me, it was a very emotional and very moving to go back and finish the job for Milty. And on his deathbed, he made me promise to write a book about reparations based on the speech I did at Hope, Hope Academy of Senior Professionals. So, yeah, it might be short, but I will do that much. So, and this was a good research for that. Thanks.
Well, growing up in Michigan and in a little town and then in rural Michigan, I had very little to no experience interacting with black people. And I therefore felt very unsure of myself when that situation arose later in life. And I now volunteer at the Muskegon Heights High School Library, where I interact with many black boys and girls, young men and women. And I'm still unsure sometimes how to interact with them. So I had participated in a book club started at the Momentum Center on racism. I read a lot. I thought I knew quite a bit. I understood racism in the United States and my own racism. So I just thought this would be a good way to kind of solidify my knowledge. Little did I know that I knew very little and that this trip would be eye-opening and life-changing. So that's why I went. I wanted to see where the civil rights movement took place. And I had traveled with Barbara before, and I knew it wouldn't just be going to see the sites. It would be, as she said, integral, an integral experience.
Well, I didn't learn about the brutality of slavery in school, and I bet most of you didn't either. The closest thing I learned was that the Civil War was fought to free the slaves in the South. That was about it. And of course, we didn't have that kind of injustice in the North, so it really wasn't a major concern of mine. I went to an integrated high school in Detroit and then college, and there were no problems for me. My first exposure to the reality was a trip I took to an Army base in 1956, and there I saw separate drinking fountains for black and white. Oh, this was a big revelation to me. On this trip, there were many places where a timeline was presented, and the current or the modern civil rights movement is often started with Brown versus the Board of Education to eliminate segregation in schools. And that was 1954. That was the year I graduated from high school, but it was still remote to me. And then after that, there was college, and that's when the modern civil rights movement of the 60s, bus boycotts and things like that started. But I was too busy being a young mother and starting a career. I didn't really know what was going on. And this trip, as I have become a mature person, was to discover the truth.
I am a daughter of a Southerner, and when I was 12 and 13, we went south to visit family, and I can remember saying to my aunt, why are these blacks getting off the sidewalk when we walk along? Why like Ellie says, do they have a separate place to go for this and that? And she would look at me and she would say, well, that's just how it is down here. So I wanted to know, that was the Jim Crow age. I didn't know that. But I've always thought I was a bit of an activist, and I like to carry signs, and I like to make noise. But it didn't seem like I could engage in very comfortable conversations with some of my family or some of my friends. And there's so much talk about what is the true history. So I thought this would be a good opportunity to learn about that. And of all the books that I've read, Brian Stevenson's book, Just Mercy, really resonated with me, and his work with the Equal Justice Initiative. As a young man, right out of law school, he went to try to help those who were on death row. And he stayed, and I have heard about his legacy museum and the lynching memorial, and I wanted to see those. And I was looking forward to being with like-minded people for several days and several nights, and knew that I could learn from them as well. And like Chris says, Barbara's trips are truly an immersion. I knew this wasn't going to be a comfortable trip, but I knew I would be safe, and I would experience things that I could process, not by myself necessarily, and that was true.
Thank you all. You've all indicated an opportunity to learn during this trip. So my next question is about the mind. I was personally really struck by the names that I read. There was one of the museums had dirt taken from the sites of lynchings with the names of the people who had been lynched, and then the monuments with some 4,400 names. And I was just so grateful for the act of giving these people the dignity of at least naming them. And so I'm wondering what each of you learned on this journey that you would like to share. Would like to start this one.
Well, one of the things that I thought was the neatest thing about this is the lynching memorial. It's got these columns and all these names. And when my dad and I were wheeling through that, we met a church group from North Carolina and their pastor who were talking about their county and going, my God, all these people killed in our county. And that church group had to decide whether after taking down the statue of Robert E. Lee, which attracted a lot of mobs, you know, how are we going to get a plaque in our town memorializing all the people that we've killed here? I mean, in the town square, this is crazy. And we talked to him for about a half hour, because Milty always talks to strangers. That's what he does. We just, you get in 20-minute conversations at gas stations with this guy. So we talked and talked about this, and they said this is not going to be easy. And to come back 2 years later and see that they have a plaque and they got it done, that was really neat. You know, so it's doing good work. It's really teaching people in parts of the world that just want to cover it up that this is time to take a look at this. Now, that was a really good thing.
I learned about horror and hope. I learned about the incompatible beliefs held by slave owners, that enslaved people were of no human value to them and yet would be advertised during the domestic slave trade as first-class Negroes, good breeders, strong back, great mind, can fix anything, and yet, you know, would be sold like a bale of cotton to somebody down the river. I also learned about the incredible strength, resilience, resourcefulness, and incomprehensibly the sense of hope maintained by our Black brothers and sisters throughout over 500 years of abuse, which is still ongoing. And I learned about the fierce commitment to nonviolence, as Ellie mentioned, during the civil rights movement. And I also learned that lynching is racial terror, racial terrorism, that it's ongoing, and we've seen recent expressions of that in our own state, our own neighboring county recently.
I learned a lot of history tied to dates, and we often learned in school the pilgrims came in 1620, I believe. But I also learned that 1619 is a very significant date. That is the date when the first ship, international ship, brought slaves to what was then British Virginia colony. 1619 is a very significant date. And then slaves were imported from Africa by many different countries. I know that England, the Netherlands, Spain, all of these countries were involved in international slave trade. And the slaves became the economic engine of the South in the plantations for cotton. Of course, we know about cotton, but rice and tobacco were two other things that brought great wealth to the South, and slaves were very, very important in building that economy. In 1807, Congress outlawed international slave trade, so we developed our domestic slave trade. In Montgomery, Alabama, was the center of all of it. It was the largest slave trading area in the country, and there were all sorts of warehouses and sites where slaves were put on the auction block and sold. And it's just hard to imagine selling another human being. And when the Emancipation Proclamation happened in 1865, I believe it was, slavery did not end. Slavery has evolved. There were about 12 years after the Emancipation and the Civil War of freedom, and then Jim Crow laws came into place, and there was prison exploitation, and then the terrorist lynching of Negro people. And this all continues today, subtly. Maybe not so subtly, in our mass incarceration with so many Black prisoners, and also in voting suppression. So it continues today. It did not stop.
Well, I also learned that there has been a deliberate, intentional roadblock to freedom for many of our Black brothers and sisters, and that white men have ruled this country. They have the power to control what history is recognized, aided by the courts and the media. We had a Jim Crow period that was eight decades old, and there was no effective civil rights legislation in that whole time, all those 80 years. The South didn't lose the war. They lost the battle, but they have controlled Reconstruction and the narrative ever since then. I also learned how damaging silence and no justice is to further generations. the fear that was elicited from these lynchings is in the DNA of these people. And it continues today. I have a black friend in Muskegon who I dearly love, and she is a hoot. That's how I say to her. But she, at the time of the leak from the Supreme Court about abortion, she was all excited and said to me, "Betty, you've got to join that progressive women's group." She said, "They're mad. They can do something." And she said, "And I ain't picking no more cotton. And if I go up for sale, you better buy me." Now, I thought that was quite humorous, but then I thought, how sad. I know how fearful black people are, and I am continually aware of that. I could go on with all of the redlining that has happened in Tulsa, how long that has taken to be resolved. 75 years when they destroyed that city. So I always carry a sign that says, "No peace, no justice, no peace." And I think that's what we're in for.
Thank you all again. And it's so hard to boil down when you have 4 incredibly full days into those pieces that you want to share. So again, talk to the people who are on the stage and the others and learn as much as you possibly can. Shadow, which deals with emotion and relationships, follows mind, because here in the West, we often have to think about things before we let them into our heart. So now we're going to talk about the shadow piece. Personally, I am committed to doing this work mostly because I know I don't need to. Mostly because I know I can decide that I'm frustrated and tired and I can give up. And for that reason, I can't ever give up. So I'm wondering about the rest of you. Having experienced the civil rights road trip, how have you been changed?
I guess I keep going first, but I'm on the edge here. It's pretty clear to me that with the latest twists and turns legally, there's a Tulsa decision that actually said, yep, you, 107 years old, and she's still there complaining that her family was killed in Tulsa 80 years ago, right? Like, it's crazy that she gets to sue for public nuisance and all the damages that might follow. I mean, it just, for years they've been suing. They tried to sue in the 20s, right? And we're told blacks can't come to court. And now, and in 2004, another federal judge said, nope, statute of limitations, you can't come to court. But there's a really smart judge somewhere there who just said, okay, enough of this. And I think that shows there's something happening in Tulsa that we could actually start to reward the people who are lynched, for example. They have a statute of limitations problem. There's got to be some shifting, and maybe it's reparations or maybe it's just token payments, but there's going to have to be a lot done to fix this problem. And that's the main thing I carried away, is we got to do something in the courts and Congress to pay these people back, you know?
I have one word about how I was changed profoundly. My empathy grew 100-fold, 1,000-fold, I don't know, for our fellow citizens who face ongoing systemic discrimination, hostility, defamation of character, and maltreatment every day of their lives. And the trauma of their forebears is carried in the genes of the kids that I see at Muskegon Heights High School every week. It shapes their lives, their experiences. So I guess I'm not so hesitant now to talk with the kids, with the staff, with people that I see anywhere on the street, and realize that, recognize their gifts and their contributions and their humanity.
I think I need to start with myself. I think of myself as a very liberal, open, accepting person, but every once in a while, I have to take a second look at my thoughts. For instance, there may be a very articulate black woman speaking, and I think, oh, and she's black too, as if that should make a difference. And little things like that do make a difference. I have stopped locking my door when I see a black person in a parking lot. I don't do that intentionally. I have to do it. So I do know that there is that subliminal prejudice that's deep within inside, and I have to work on myself. And I also have, as Chris mentioned, a great deal of empathy for the generational impact of racism on today's black citizens. And so I will catch myself more often than I really want to, but I hope that it's less than it has been.
Well, I think I have done more reading since I've been home than I could imagine. And I feel like I have found my voice. And I have black children and brown grandchildren. And our family sometimes has difficulty talking about uncomfortable subjects. And I hope to learn those words that don't shut somebody up or make them defensive. 'Cause then we go nowhere. And I listened to a young man who, with his partner, developed a long talk, which is alongtalk.com. And his goal is to have a non-racist at every dinner table. So I have signed up for his workshop. And the little bit that I've heard is about, don't be ashamed of your white privilege. Use your white privilege, because it works. So that's how I think it's changed me.
Which is an excellent segue into our last question. About spirit, that light or that consciousness that dwells within each of us and which motivates us to action. Because none of this is all that important if we don't do anything with it. Spirit offers the challenge to convert change into action. So my final question is, what will you do now and how can others join you in this important work?
Well, Milton's really good at making me promise to do things. And I was like, Milty, I'm a white guy. I can't write a book about reparations, right? But he talked me into it, and I realized people are out there meeting in conventions about reparations, right? Why don't I go to those? Why don't I see what the speakers at those say? And maybe I could contribute something. I've been white living through all these wonderful experiences where I get everything. I get the big house and I get all the appreciation while my buddies down the street can't even buy into the neighborhood because the realtors won't show them the houses I buy that triple in value, right? I mean, a reparations issue. We've got a whole bunch of money sitting here that's ill-gotten gain that the courts don't like ill-gotten gains. When you sell the Brooklyn Bridge, you don't get to keep it. You know, it's like, this is not a good thing that we've done, and we need to do something about it. So I'll try to do something, and hopefully Milty won't curse me with something from... He gave me a polyester allergy when I didn't get rid of all the polyester clothes, so I now had to throw away or, you know, get rid of all that.
I'm not going to write a book. But I will continue to stand every Saturday from noon to 1 p.m., holding a sign for peace and justice, various signs for peace and justice. And I will unashamedly and boldly stand next to the sign that says Black Lives Matter. And usually one or two people will open their window and shout, All Lives Matter. And if they would stop, I would have a conversation with them, I think. Now, maybe I'll have that courage. Continue to work at the library at Muskegon Heights and be more aggressive, not aggressive, but in talking with those kids, finding out about their lives, and letting them know that I value their gifts and abilities in our community. And I'll leave it there.
Well, I wish I was 10, 15 years younger so I could do some physical things. I still can, but at my advanced age, most of my work will be in support of others. And the two areas that I'm particularly focused on that make a difference today is mass prison incarceration. And there is an organization right in this community, Humanity for Prisoners is doing something. Maybe I should be more involved with that. And the other thing is voting rights policies. Voter suppression is making such a difference. And if more people vote, we can perhaps change some of these conditions.
Well, I think I've shared some of the things that I'm going to continue to do. But one is June 11th. There's a National March for Our Lives that people might want to join us with. I just want to say that freedom is pretty fragile. That in 1972, George Wallace won the Democratic primary for President of the United States in Michigan. That's the George Wallace that says segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation always. So it was the Republicans who crossed over, who were able to vote, who voted for George Wallace, as well as some Democrats. But we have to be watchful. That was also the year that I was living in Pontiac in 1972, where 10 buses that were to integrate schools and carry children happened. There were 10 buses burned. So, and I would recommend Barbara's town hall meetings. They're very helpful. And her trips.
The Momentum Center is continuing to work to address this really difficult issue. We have some voter registration drives coming up. I think being aware of the need to really mobilize politically is important. Please take time to understand who's running for offices, especially your very local offices, county commissioners, school board. Understand who is on the ballot and be strategic and aligning with people who will continue to support diversity, equity, and inclusion in our community. We also have a number of events coming up in this next year that you'll surely hear about, and I encourage you to participate. And another way that you could all get involved, those of you who haven't been on the Civil Rights Road Trip yet, we're in the process of trying to firm up dates to return in the fall, probably in November. So if that's something you're interested in, please let me know so that we can have you on that first-come list. I want to close with one of our reflections from our last day on the Civil Rights Road Trip. It was back in 1946 when Margaret Halsey said, "One of the less dismaying aspects of race relations in the United States is that their improvement is not a matter of a few people having a great deal of courage. It is a matter of a great many people having just a little courage." May we all tap into our reserve of courage. Namaste.